With the Democratic primary wide open for the office of Illinois Attorney General, many candidates are getting a late start getting their campaigns up and running. There will be less time for some to present a clear and focused message. Some may even be compelled to call Eric Sedler. Sedler is the co-owner and founder of the public relations firm Kivett. Kivett doesn't do political campaigns, but instead help with corporate communications, media strategies, and the very important crisis management. He won't help candidates get elected, but he definitely helps shape the public policy they may support. If you know the name Eric Sedler, it's because he's been doing this for a very long time in Chicago. Kivett's a national company at this point with 70 employees in 5 different offices. But Sedler cut his teeth in Illinois politics once working with Speaker Mike Madigan. But he also he's known for partnering with David Axelrod and the famed political consultant company ASGK Public Strategies. Sedler's listed in the Who's Who in Chicago Business by Cranes, and in 2015 also named as one of the top 20 most powerful political insiders in the state of Illinois. Tonight, we talk PR, public policy, and putting out fires with Eric Sedler, my guest at the big table. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start right with the Attorney General's race. I mean, I'm assuming you love this stuff.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, I kind of right at the top talked about that they're kind of behind the eight ball in the way that usually these campaigns start months ahead of time. You know, we've seen in the governor's race, they were doing this a year out.
Right.
You know, what's your advice to candidates that are starting at this late game? What disadvantage are they at?
Sure. Well, this is definitely was a shock for everybody. So, you know, I think that there are a number of different things that these candidates that have announced they're running have to take into account, and they're all in a little bit of a different spot. You have, you know, somebody like Kwame Raoul, who's been talking about higher office. His name has been floated around for multiple years. So presumably he was thinking about the pieces that go into a real campaign. But it's not the same as actually having to implement it. Then you've got somebody like Elaine Nekritz, who, you know, was spent a long time in the General Assembly, just announced that she was stepping down, and then all of a sudden announces she's running. And then somebody like Jesse Reese, who's not been in elective office, but he's certainly been around government. So they're all, just to take them, and then Drury, you know, also was going to run for governor now.
Right.
So they're all coming at it from a little different sort of starting off point. But I think for all of them, the common denominator is they have to figure out what is their path to being able to get elected in the primary.
Is it the same concept that we hear at the national stage where you're like, when you say path, you're like, you're looking at different counties, different areas, like, this is my path, I'm going to go through Southern Illinois, or I'm going to make sure that I win Chicago. Is it that what you mean by path?
Yeah, exactly. The reality is, in a Democratic primary, the vast majority of the vote comes in the Collar County. So I think most of them, and they're all from this area, so I think most of them are trying to figure out, hey, do I have a natural base to start from? So you can think about geography, you can think about, you know, other kinds of factors, but that's probably a starting off point, is sort of like, where is my base that I can build from? You know, another factor is they all have different amounts of money. Mm-hmm. Some of them who have been in elective office that have been able to raise money, they certainly, you know, have a little bit of advantage there. And then there's the infrastructure of putting together the mechanics of the campaign. They have to hire staff. They
right.
have to
volunteers,
to figure out
all that kind of stuff.
All the infrastructure. They have to articulate policy positions, and they have to have the apparatus to go campaign. So, you know, if I had to say, you know, who has an upper hand, I think it has to go to those that have been in office, those who have been talking about it for a while and have some ability to raise money and then can show that they can credential themselves because they come at it with a certain base that they can build from.
You've been around politics your entire life. Is when you're running for campaign, you're running for office, running for this specific office, but generically, is it about the personality of the candidate? Is it about the issue they choose to run on? Is it about how good they are with raising money? Like, what's the secret ingredient to make a great politician running for state office?
I think it does start with biography and the personal story. I think that's how you see candidates really break through. When it comes to policy, I think that it matters to an extent, but the vast majority of voters are probably not reading 10-point plans. They're making a judgment about a person. They say, hey, does this person have a story, a personal story, a professional biography of accomplishment or having overcome something or having demonstrated something that I can respect, that I can admire? I think that is what people tend to look for. And I think those stories, whether they're personal, professional, is what helps somebody really start to stand out. Again, I don't think that people really, you know, are reading through policy papers as much as they're making judgments about, is this somebody that I can look up to, that I can respect, that I could feel good about standing in.
Well,
and
you see
for?
This more in the city of Chicago than you see it in the state of Illinois, but there will be factions or you know, slices of Democratic Party, progressive or moderate. Does that play at all? Like the idea that a candidate's issues or where they stand in terms of the same political party, is that important when you're trying to court voters and trying to win an election?
I think it depends on the election. For something like attorney general, it's not going to be this. It's not going to be the primary issue, because I think you can go through. They're all more or less talking about similar kinds of issues. And even the race for governor, I think if you look at the Democratic side, there are areas of emphasis, and you can talk about maybe who, you know, is sort of more establishment, less establishment. But the reality is, if you go through and listen to them talk about health care or taxes or education or those kind of big issues, there's much more similarity than there is difference. I agree with you, though, that at the city level and obviously at the national level, there is certainly this tension or this debate between what we
like
would
an internal party debate.
Absolutely. Right. Between what would be considered more establishment and more progressive. And you can see it again in the certainly in the governor's race. Somebody like JB would be considered more establishment, and Pawar, some of these other candidates, and even Kennedy's trying to position himself, you know, a more progressive. Ultimately, I'm not sure there's that like clear delineation the way that that we have seen maybe in city council or, you know, even nationally.
You know, we've had conversations on the show before about how you use media when it comes to elections. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that always gets brought up is that the state is different than, you know, Donald Trump ran on this idea that he really didn't need to have a lot of money because he had media talking about him at every turn. He didn't have to put ads on the TV as much. But when you talk about the state race, it feels like the last weekend counts. You know, that's when voters start to recognize there's an election on Tuesday. So they look at the ads. They look at what is on Sunday night, you know, in the newscast. Is that really a factor? I mean, you're in this business. You make commercials. You do this kind of stuff. Is the campaign ad, the television ad, the radio ad, is it like you need the money for that to win an election in the state of Illinois?
It still is a big, big part of what campaigns have to do. Now, you know, obviously it's not just television anymore. It's very heavily around digital and social. But ironically, a lot of the kind of old, what we would consider to be like old school tactics, like direct mail, are still really common and important. There's a whole other aspect which is less visible, but that is really important, which is the organization and what they would call the field structure. And really, it's about trying to figure out who your voters are and getting them out to vote. Mm. I think there's a lot of sophistication, and as a result, a lot of money gets put into.
Is that where the money goes when you say they're raising this much money? It's going to be the most expensive campaign in the history of campaigns. Is it the fact that they're spending money on this very specific data to get right at the voter they need to come out?
I think it varies by campaigns. The truth is that television advertising, especially in a big metropolitan market like Chicago, is going to represent a plurality of what a candidate is going to spend money on if they have those kind of resources. You know, JB, again, obviously spending millions of dollars early trying to credential himself as the front runner. So there's a certain strategy in that. There's whether it's a good strategy or not. You know, I guess we'll find out. He's going to outraise or outspend. He's not going to outraise. He will give to himself and outspend everybody else. And if that, you know, maybe that's a good strategy. But so it's not so much that I think they're spending the tons of money on data and field, but I think it's increasingly an important part, especially in a primary where you're really having to concentrate on a certain sliver of voters.
I could talk about this stuff all night. This is great. Eric Sedler's my guest. He, of course, his public relations firm, Kivett, a national company at this point, he's got 70 employees over 5 different offices, works with a lot of corporate clients as well as in his past political campaigns. We'll talk more with Eric about, I'm going to transition as well to corporate communications, because we see, you know, that is becoming another area with so many more outlets when it comes to social media and Twitter and other places for corporations to put their foot in their mouths. they need Eric Sedler. He's my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. My guest tonight at the big table, Eric Sedler. He is the co-owner and founder of Kivit, national media company, public relations company, 70 employees, five different offices around the country. Used to be the partner with David Axelrod at ASGK Public Strategies. Long history in politics and corporate communications. We're talking about all those issues tonight at the big table. Let's talk about how, you know, and I want to talk about corporate communications and putting out fires. That's a big part of the conversation tonight. But I've noticed back to politics that we've seen in the last couple of years more of an emphasis on almost taking the candidates out of campaign ads, where we see, and whether it be the soda tax stuff that we're seeing now, just sort of inundated on all media channels. We saw Governor Rauner do this, where he was actually talking to voters about the budget, but there was no election he was talking about. I mean, this idea that the idea of the campaign ad has, they've just gotten rid of the campaign part. Talk about that. I mean, because you guys are involved in that kind of stuff. I mean, when did that start becoming the way that people who had interest in this wanted to express themselves?
Well, it's definitely something that we're seeing more and more of, and we can attribute it to a whole range of factors, money being put into policy and politics generally and other factors. You know, the truth is that you could go back probably all the way to the, certainly into the 90s, and see examples, especially if for people that can remember the old days in telecommunications, you would see campaign style advertising trying to influence policy. And so there were examples of that kind of work happening. I think it's become much more prolific now for a couple of different reasons. One is that it doesn't also always have to be as expensive. It doesn't always have to be the big television ad campaign. You can use social media. You can use less expensive tactics to do that kind of work. Ultimately, though, the goal is always the same, which is to try to either genuinely move public opinion around an issue or create a perception that the public is getting engaged on an issue. So when Governor Rauner has advertising going on to talk about the budget, he's trying to define the terms of the debate about the budget, and he's trying to either put pressure on the Democrats or he's trying to give cover to the Republicans. He's trying to use, again, campaign style tactics to build policy support for policy.
Well,
issues.
I mean, this is your bread and butter in this area, but does it work? I mean, do you find data that says that voters or just residents at this point, I mean, voters doesn't even matter because we're not voting for anything, but that we are swayed, the polls come out and say, yeah, now there's a different number on this issue when it comes to whatever public policy is being talked about in the media.
Well, I think that the measurement of whether it's successful is different because you're not necessarily trying to get millions of people to do something. You're really, again, trying to define an issue. So you brought up the soda tax. Had there not been all of this advertising, there probably wouldn't be as much media attention. There probably, and it wouldn't become controversial, regardless of what people think about the issue. It's become a big public issue in a way that, you know, there are all kinds of taxes that get passed all the time. You know, there's the plastic bag tax and other kinds of taxes that maybe because there weren't interest groups with the money to spend, these taxes kind of came and went, and whether people like them or not, they didn't become politically controversial. Whereas the soda tax happens to be an issue where there are some really strong vested interest. And so it becomes a bigger issue. So I think it depends if the goal is to create a perception of a big public debate or to put pressure on elected officials to vote a certain way, then the kind of public advocacy style campaigning can be very effective.
If successful, and we see this, like I said, playing out in Chicago right now, Cook County, do you see a future in which whether it be healthcare, tax reform, who should be on what stamp? I mean, are we going to get to the point where every issue that's in modern American or even local politics is being played out on television in front of you in advertising?
I don't think it'll get to that point, but I do think that, again, because of all the different communication tools that are out there, the sort of the barrier to entry is a lot lower than it used to be. And so you can do more things and create more of a sense of an issue without maybe the same resources that would have been required, you know, 5-10 years ago. Ultimately, though, for these campaigns to really take off, they need some combination of an interest group that's really prepared to spend money, or there has to be a genuine public interest in a particular issue. Right. So I think it'll be unlikely that sort of very obscure issues, you know, rise to that level.
Eric Sedler from Kivett with me tonight at the big table. We're talking about all things public policy, PR, putting out fires, things like that, and all the media strategy that goes into being a public relations firm in 2017. You know, I'm fascinated by that issue only because as a voter and as a citizen, I wonder how more than the candy bar commercial, more than the car commercial, more than all the other products, if I'm being manipulated. And I guess that's the question, like, where I'm like, I'm not sure if this is partisan. If it's not partisan, they throw a little thing at the bottom that says, you know, coalition for blah, 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 blah. You don't know what side. I mean, I feel more than regular advertising that there's the risk of that. I mean, do you think about those kind of issues when developing campaigns and putting out advertising for public policy and so forth?
We absolutely do. And again, there's been an evolution in the industry over the years. You used to hear terms like AstroTurf campaigns and front groups and that sort of thing. I think that sort of style where you could really mask who is behind things is not the way the industry, it's not certainly not the way the reputable practitioners operate. I think there's a real understanding that you have to disclose who's behind it, what their rationale is. You know, ultimately, and this is true, I think, whether you're a political candidate, an issue campaign, or a corporate campaign, you have to be credible in the things that you say for people to take you seriously. It is possible that you can get away with that for a little while, but it doesn't last over time. And I think there's sort of an irony in the work that we do, which is you hear the derogatory terms like, oh, this is going to be spin and you're going to do this kind of work. The reality is that we're generally telling our clients, you have to tell the truth. And you have to tell facts. You certainly can do it in a way that is consistent with the points that you want to get across.
Right.
But you ultimately have to tell the truth. I really believe that the truth eventually comes out. And it's really a matter of setting the terms of when you provide information and how you do it. But I don't really see a lot of successful campaigns out there that are not grounded in fact.
As somebody in this business, do you have to advise corporate clients when they're like, well, what if we just lied about that? I mean, you find like when they're like, OK, guys, no, please, we're going down the wrong path.
It's funny. In all the years that I've done this, I've never once had a client say, we want to go out and we're hiring you to help us lie, or we're going to go do this bad thing, and we want you to help you. We need you to help us do this bad thing.
Well, I mean, I think of the days of cigarette companies, tobacco companies, alcohol companies. There's stated history in this business of corporate clients wanting to change the narrative that their product doesn't do harm or things like that. I mean, they may not see it as a lie. They may see it as we want to present alternative facts or the idea of the facts here and avoid these facts. So, I mean, how do you deal with that kind of thing where there may be a client that comes forward saying, I know this is what people think of us and that's true, but let's talk about this truth instead.
Well, I think tobacco is a special case because it was clear at a certain point that there were these negative health benefits and there really was nothing positive about it. Most of the projects that we work on end up being in a situation where there's good facts on multiple sides. And the truth is usually not owned by one side. And so it really comes down to telling the facts in a way that advance your argument, but also in a way that is credible with the public.
Right, right.
Because ultimately, you're trying to advance an argument, change public opinion. But in order to do that, you have to be fact-based and you have to be credible in doing it.
Eric Sedler's my guest tonight at the big table. His company, Kivett, national company at this point, a public relations firm, 70 employees, 5 different offices. He was on the Who's Who in Chicago business list with Cranes, also in 2015 named as one of the 20 most powerful political insiders in Illinois. Congratulations on that. We're talking about PR, public policy. And when we come back, let's talk about putting out fires. We haven't got to the corporate part of this and crisis communications. Eric Sedler, my guest tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up the 9 o'clock hour, Tim and Katie Tutton will be here. We'll talk to them about the Hideout Block Party. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, the Swap Meet with Greg Flam. We do it every Wednesday night. If you got some collectibles, memorabilia, just stuff you want to brag about, 312-981-7200. One of my favorite hours of the whole week. People calling in. And last week, they said someone had a mess kit from the Civil War. It's like their great-great-great-grandfather's mess kit. And then so many great things in between. So that's coming up tonight with Greg, 312-981-7200. My guest at the big table tonight, Eric Sedler. He is the man behind Kivett, the public relations firm that used to be partners with David Axelrod at ASGK, which is famous in Chicago for working public relations, political campaigns, things of that nature. Kivett is more corporate client stuff. And we've kind of teased it out throughout this hour. It's really, really interesting work because, you know, and I saw some of the writings you had on the site about some of the newer corporate issues when it comes to companies like Uber or Facebook or other places where they are dealing with, you know, trying to put their front-facing is that they're cool, hip, progressive company. And behind the scenes, they have the same issues that every corporation seems to have when it comes to their personnel, whether it be issues of labor or sexual harassment, things of that nature, and how they handle it almost always turns into a clown show. Eric, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with companies that don't necessarily believe they need a corporate message?
Well, there are a couple of different points. One is you reference companies like Uber and Facebook and some of these, you know, highly visible technology companies. There's always a risk when you present yourselves, you market yourselves, you brand yourselves as being one way, and then facts come out that show that you are actually acting a different way. And the reality is that as companies get bigger, problems happen. And so one is it's very important that you not hold yourself out to be something that you're not. So that's one issue that we see happen to companies.
Right.
I think that the other reality is that the way that people get information and the way they form opinions about companies is changing very, very dramatically. You can take just an extreme but obvious example of the airlines and when something bad happens to a passenger.
Perfect
so
example, right?
Before smartphones and before social media, if something like that happened, maybe 100 people would know about it and they would have one-off conversations. They'd say, oh my gosh, you won't believe what happened today. They'd tell their spouse or their friend. But now things get captured on video and they suddenly go out to millions of people and they go out simultaneously. So something that, again, pre-smartphone, pre-internet, or pre-social media would be an isolated event that limited visibility now becomes national news.
It becomes the number one story on national news, right?
Exactly. And again, it happens in a very, very rapid, immediate kind of way.
How do you – is the way that you strategize for that, if you're helping a corporation strategize for the moment that you need to put out fires, how do you – Do you have to put resources to that kind of thing? Do you have to have them prepared for if this kind of thing comes along? Here's the, break glass, you know, in case of emergency. Do they have to put resources into something to be prepared for this kind of thing to happen?
Well, they do. This is one of probably the biggest changes I've seen in how companies prepare for issues or crises. I think of them as the known knowns. There are certain things that companies know from the past, or they know from their own planning process, that there's some probability or likelihood or seriousness of issues that could happen. It might be 10 things, it might be 20
right.
things, depending on
the company. If you're a customer service company, you probably have a list of things that could go wrong in customer service.
Absolutely. And you think about some of the obvious things around data breaches and outages and workforce issues. I mean, there's some pretty obvious things that companies can figure at some point these things are going to happen. And there was a time in the past when you had days, weeks to prepare for something of how to respond. Those days are over. And I think companies understand that now they really have to plan and be prepared, because if something like that happens, there's no news cycle. It happens immediately. So we definitely see a lot of the companies that are highly visible spending resources, and it's not only money, it's time and training
like that.
And those kind of resources around planning. So some of them will have, you know, like the plan on their, you know, and then their office, and they'll say, hey, listen, if this thing happens, this is what we have to do. So it's a real change of emphasis of the way that companies have to plan.
Yeah. You know, it almost feels most of the times in which a company gets in hot water is when they're messing with social media. You know, as someone who has corporate clients, and a lot of times those corporate clients say the last thing they're thinking about is their Twitter account. I have Johnny the intern on the Twitter account, and something happens, and Johnny the intern says, so what, as a reply, or hits the wrong button, or likes something you shouldn't like, as we saw with Ted Cruz. I mean, it feels more and more like that's the area that corporate clients need to get better at.
I think companies are still, even today, they are trying to figure out what is the appropriate profile for a company to have on social media. We have these conversations. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about a Fortune 100 company or you're talking about a mid-sized private company, because there's no right answer. And that's where I think that companies, you know, have to work through it. So I think that there was certainly a time when there was a view that it could be a little bit of an afterthought. You could have, you know, the young, inexperienced person in charge of the send button on digital. I think that part is changing. I think the bigger issue for most companies is how aggressive, how visible should we be on social media? What is the right posture? Is it from a company? Is it from an executive? Is it from a spokesperson? How do we interact with customers if something bad is going on around a customer service issue? How do we interact in a way that is appropriate but doesn't escalate an issue? So those, I think, are debates that happen within companies and firms like ours, you know, all the time. And I think we'll continue to be having to work through that because it'll continue to change.
All right, let's talk about the golden goose. Let's talk about putting out fires. This is the part that I think everybody wants to know about. I mean, if you're a corporate client of yours is an airline, and they have something that happens that's similar to has happened to other airlines where they've mistreated a customer or tweeted something out. I said after Hurricane Irma, you know, there was price gouging and things of that nature and the insensitive responses from some of the airline tweets. And you get yourself on the front pages of the paper and possibly the national news, CNN, is talking about it. What's the call like? What do you do? What does Kivett do to come in and put those fires out? What's the plan?
Well, there's besides the rule that I already said, which is you have to tell the truth. The other rule is that you really get one chance to make it right. Where you see companies run into trouble and you see it over and over and over again is they come out with some incremental statement and it's not enough. And then 2 days later, they have to go out further.
Or they change their tune or change their facts.
Right. So it's this kind of slow drip of trying to manage issues. Whereas, and you can see the hands of the lawyers and different advocates that have different agendas, because within companies, the communication function, the communicator is one advocate at the table. You have lawyers, you have other actors that have a different agenda because they care more about managing for litigation or they care more about other issues. But I think you can see example time and again, you really get one chance to do things right. And if you really are willing to go out to tell the truth, to do it forcefully, then by and large, you stand a better chance of de-escalating managing an issue than if you come out with a half-hearted statement, then it's a half apology, then it has to be a three-quarters of apology, and then ultimately you apologize, but it's not credible because you didn't do it the right way the first time.
There's also the other flip side, and we saw this a little bit. We see this with data breaches all the time, Equifax, where we find out that there was a data breach 6 months ago, or Yahoo, this happened as well, where you're like, what, that was a year ago? And we're just finding out this now? There's a part of managing the crisis is not going to the media, not talking to the press, not putting out a statement, and trying to work behind the scenes. I mean, talk about that part of putting out fires.
I believe that the truth always comes out, and I believe that the best way that companies can manage difficult issues is to initiate sharing the information. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to go hold a press conference and be on national TV, but I believe that with the level of media outlets that are out there, with the level of attention that big companies get, the idea that there would be some massive data breach that would never come out, I think, is not realistic. So I think that credibility is really enhanced when a company says, here's what happened, mm-hmm. here's what we did, and here's what we're going to do moving forward.
And ultimately they do that. It's just always criticized on how fast they do that. I mean, in Equifax and Yahoo in particular, that's the head scratcher to me, that the breach is out there and we know how fast this stuff can instant. You can be being fished tomorrow. And some of these companies wait months to tell us.
They do. But I think the examples that you give underscore my point that they're not credible. Imagine if they would have come out. Obviously, you need time to understand what happened. But imagine if they would have come out and said, listen, we know that there was a data breach. We have stopped it. We are gathering the facts and we're going to communicate as we get facts. But we are going to be the source of information here. You know, that is it's a very hard thing to get companies to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. But again, I think it's just overwhelming evidence that that's how you stay credible is when you come out, you communicate, you set the tone, you determine where, when, and how, but you're telling the facts.
Have there been times, Eric, where you're in your career, your illustrious career, whether it be with ASGK or Kivit or others, where you made the wrong decision, where you made a mistake, where you said, this is what we're going to do as a company, this is how we're going to get in front of it, and then you're like, oh, geez, I'm going to walk that back.
Of course you make mistakes. Some of these things come down to judgment calls where you are making a judgment about what the right approach is, and you...
In the moment,
yeah. And you expect that it will have a certain public reaction, and it has a different public reaction, and... I think anybody that operates at the sort of the level and scrutiny that, you know, our clients operate will say the same thing, that, you know, hopefully it's few and far between. But there are certainly occasions where you misread an issue. And again, hopefully you can take that experience and learn from it, because there are certain things where you have data, you have facts, you know how issues are being received by the public. And then there are other issues where you are kind of in the fog of a moment, and you have to make a judgment call.
You know, I think about some of the issues in Chicago. You know, and you're a Chicago guy. You've been here for a long time. And I think about how public opinion and how many times we hear people say, you know, if they would have done it this way instead, I think, you know, I was thinking about was the Lucas Museum. You know, if they would have come out and said it was an art museum and not a Star Wars museum, if they would have come out with the design beforehand, if they would have looked at different locations, like so many second guessing. But the truth and the reason that people are saying that is because they feel like the message and the way that it went about was botched. You know, like there's second guessing in there. Is Chicago unique in the way that cities approach these kind of conflicts? I mean, as you as someone who has managed many different campaigns in so many different areas, is Chicago a unique city when it comes to public opinion and dealing with this kind of stuff?
Well, Chicago definitely has a culture of big spirited debates, and that's for sure. And you can see it. Yeah, really, you look back on all different kinds of big issues. It can be something like the Lucas Museum that you mentioned, any sort of big issue that's happening. We could go back even
soda tax happening
the
right
soda
now.
Soda tax, right. or other kind of big land use, big infrastructure projects. So I think it's healthy in the sense that I think that public input is important. I think that having community meetings and getting public input is part of the public process. It's how you build trust in different kinds of projects over time. But the process itself is generally very, very messy, because in a lot of these things, again, you have different groups. You have the city, you have the mayor, they're trying to advance a certain thing. You have the other entities that they have their own agenda. Some of them are, maybe they're not from Chicago. They're not accustomed to kind of the rough and tumble that happens here. So I think it's true. But in every big city that I've worked in, there are certain issues that get people...
Get their attention. Yeah.
And usually it involves issues around how public land gets used, transportation, congestion, all those kind of issues that are real, you know, that affect people in a pretty immediate way. But again, I think on balance, Chicago maybe has a little bit more of this kind of approach. But overall, I think it's more healthy than not.
You know, I never think of politics as a place where it's just constant campaigns. I mean, obviously they run campaigns to be elected. But what we've seen, and I guess in this conversation, almost every item that a mayor gets behind or a governor gets behind or an issue or a piece of legislation, whatever it might be, there needs to be a campaign that goes along with that. Is that new to politics in the way that there needs to be more thought on the long-term projection of how this is going to play out, what we need to do to push this, to get people behind this, as opposed to, I'm just going to do this and see what happens?
Yeah, I definitely think that there is more systematic, we can call it campaign-style tactics, that go into policy issues. And again, I think that it's a function of, you have outside interests that have money to put into issues, and you also have all these different platforms available to engage the public or create a perception that you're engaging the public. There's no question, when you talk about big issues, if we take the state, for example, whether it's tax reform, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, that there are going to be vested interests that are going to try to define the issue. Now, it doesn't mean that there's more of a vested interest on one side of an issue or right. not, because there's a whole history of organized labor being very active in policy issues. There's a history of the business community being active. So it's not so much that it's one political faction over another. I think it's more a function of, there are high stakes issues, and there's both, I think, a combination of more yeah. money and more ways to,
and they need to get it right. My last question tonight, a question I ask a lot of people who come through, artists and other people from Chicago. I mean, you have offices set up all around the country, and this is, you've seen your brand expand in terms of corporate clients. I mean, a lot of people in New York and Washington, D.C., to just to name a few. Why Chicago? Why stay here? Why? What is it about Chicago that keeps you, Eric Sedler, here?
Well, I think that Chicago is the best city in America, and one of the things about working in different places is, when you say you're from Chicago, every time I say it, I just got back from New York today. You say I'm from Chicago, anybody that's been to Chicago says that is a great city. That's a beautiful city, and I think it's just a fantastic city. We have our challenges like any other big city, and it's easy to focus on some of those issues, and they need to be focused on, and they need to be addressed. At the same time, I think if we compare Chicago to any other big city, we have just tremendous advantages and great people. You just always hear about, you know, the people who live in Chicago, the beauty. I think people are just surprised when they come here and they see what Chicago has to offer. So to me, Chicago is just is a great city.
Eric Sedler, his company Kivett, the public relations firm, a national company at this point, 70 employees, 5 different offices around the country. Sedler was listed to the Who's Who in Chicago Business by Crain's, and in 2015 also named as one of the top 20 most powerful political insiders in the state of Illinois. Eric, can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing your secrets here at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.